supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. No, I am not running in slow motion on the beach. I'm sitting here in the studio with Dr. Joel Fish, and we're going to talk about the mind of the athlete today. Bodie Miller was a hands-down favorite to win the men's downhill skiing in Sochi last night. He finished eighth. No one knows why, but one has to wonder if something got into his head and stole his focus. Last week, and this really intrigues me, last week's Super Bowl was between arguably the two best teams in the NFL, the Denver Broncos and the Seattle Seahawks. It was supposed to be a close contest with the best offense playing against the best defense. Denver collapsed, and we're talking about more than 30 players here. So as a team, something happened. I mean, it wasn't just talent because they were matched talent. So we're going to talk to Dr. Fish about that and other athletes and parents of athletes. Dr. Fish is a sports psychology expert. He has worked and currently works with all ages and skill levels, a lot of college professional sports here in Philadelphia. He is involved in the Olympics. He's been a consultant for the Flyers, Sixers, Phillies, and for the Philadelphia Charge USA Women's National Soccer Team. He's also the author of the book, 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sports Parent. Welcome back, my friend.
Nice to be here, Dan.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Joel, answer my two questions. Let's start with the Denver Broncos. What happened?
Well, I think what you see oftentimes in a Super Bowl situation or in the Olympics is the psychology of being the favorite versus the underdog. And what I see happening when I watch a game like the Super Bowl is that Peyton Manning and the Broncos, best offense in football, were the favorites over an underdog Seattle team that had a great defense, but less was expected of them.
I'm going to argue with you. It's only a 3-point difference. I mean, they were close.
They were close in terms of the odds makers, but I would suggest that from their history, from the focus on Peyton Manning, from the consequences of losing, there was more pressure on the Broncos, from my perspective.
Okay, go on.
And what I see happening oftentimes, and I see it happening in the Olympics too, is that there's a different kind of pressure on the favorite. Peyton Manning, in this particular case, the Broncos, legacy of being the best quarterback ever. Momentum starts to go against them from the first play, and the underdog is able to play as if they've got nothing to lose. And the favorite starts to feel a little pressure, and I think at that elite level, if you're feeling pressure 3 or 5%, that's going to get in the way of your reaction time, your spontaneity, your creativity. And sometimes momentum is like a snowball going down a hill. It gets bigger and bigger, and I think that's really what happened in the Super Bowl. That momentum just kept building. Seattle had nothing to lose, and the results were very one-sided.
What was going on in the minds of, I mean, did they quit? Was it conscious that they quit or unconscious?
Well, my hunch would be, again, assuming was a team that hadn't been stopped all year, that psychologically, again, you're putting them into uncharted territory. Wait a minute, this isn't the way the script is supposed to be. And then all of a sudden, and this can happen at the pro level, let alone at the college level, let alone at the high school level, the mindset of an individual, and it can spread to a team, is, oh boy, what's going on here? Or, here we go again, if a team's in a slump. And all of a sudden, when things are starting to go against you mentally, you start to get tentative, as opposed to the team like Seattle staying aggressive. And in pro sports, even at that level, the mind can start to affect you in a way where pressure inhibits your ability to do what you can typically do.
I want to change gears just a little bit, Joel. I want to talk about what Malcolm Gladwell said in his book, The Outliers. He said that at this level, all athletes have similar levels of athletic skills, which is what we were just talking about. He said the difference between the superior athletes who, say, make it to the Olympics and those who don't is the number of hours practicing over their lifetimes. There's got to be more than that, Joel.
Yeah, I really don't believe that. I believe practice is certainly important. In sports psychology, we talk about the mental game, and I've asked thousands of athletes of all levels what percentage of performance is mental, confidence, composure, concentration, communication, teamwork. Athletes, no matter what the sport, say the game is largely mental, 30, 40, 50%. Mm. But the mental game doesn't substitute for talent, hard work, preparation. I think more physical practice doesn't necessarily prepare you for the pressures and the emotions that come along with competition. Sports psychology is about what you feel, what you think. And in my mind, the difference between the good athletes and the great athletes are not only the physical talent. You need a one in a million talent to be an Olympian, but you also need a one in a million personality or ability to deal with pressure. Huh. Otherwise, you get weeded out of the system. So where I would disagree with Gladwell is I don't believe he's putting enough emphasis on the emotional and the thoughtful part of being a great athlete.
Spoken like a true sports psychologist. I want to talk about this business of self-talk. I've been reading a lot about it. And when we spoke to you earlier, Joel, you described that self-talk as a mental skill. Tell us what that means, because I know there's a lot of studies that say it creates positive results.
Positive self-talk is really just saying the same things to yourself as you would to a friend if you wanted to help them be motivated or shake off a mistake in a sports setting. Don't worry about it. Shake it off. It's okay. Today's my day. I feel like a champion. There's all kinds of evidence that in terms of either mental preparation or in the game itself, the way you think affects the way you feel, which can affect the way you perform. And so part of the skill, which some people have easier than others, is just giving themselves positive messages. And even at the highest level, sometimes because competitors are so driven, that gets them into a situation where it can be helpful. But if they don't learn how to let go of a mistake, calm down, have positive thoughts when things aren't going their way, the same trait that makes them so good, their competitiveness, can really start to work against them because they try too hard, they get down on themselves, and it's hard for them to stay in the moment and move on to the next play.
You're talking about, you know, the self-talk business. It's, you know, AA traditionally said fake it till you make it. And what we're learning about the brain and biology is that really works. I mean, we know smiling releases endorphins in the brain. So if you smile when you're not happy, eventually you're going to feel happy. And there's a wonderful TED Talk out now, and it's one of the top 10 TED Talks. But what she's established is research that shows that body language changes mm-hmm. your mood. You know, hold your shoulders back and your head up, and you're going to feel differently over time. So, you know, the self-talk business really works. I want to play you a short clip here. This is tennis pro Yulia Bolotova. She was professional tennis registry's Player of the Year in 2012. She was ranked number 6 in National Women's Open doubles. She's won a lot of USTA titles and is on this year's World Cup team. She's the only player from Philadelphia. She spoke with Gita Simons a little while earlier.
When I was younger, I also had negative self-talk. And then you go through a learning process. You set yourself motivated, disciplined, and set goals. And once that all comes together, you have self-positive talk instead of negative. And once in a while, of course, you'll have that feeling frustrated. You can see that on the pro level. Quickly forget about it, kind of walk away from it, and then move on. But that comes from confidence, that you can do anything you set to do.
That was tennis pro, Philadelphia-based tennis pro Yulia Bolotova, talking with Mike and Scott earlier. I just realized I've been hogging you, Joel, this whole show, and I didn't give out the phone numbers, which means that I do have an unconscious. I didn't want those people to be horning in on our discussion. But I'll give out the phone numbers anyway, because my producer, Gita Simon's making all sorts of gestures back there that I don't want to repeat. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. In all seriousness, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you if you're an athlete, if you're a parent of an athlete, if you'd like to weigh in on this discussion. We are having a good time with Dr. Joel Fish, sports psychologist. I want to talk about a different kind of self-talk, and that's the kind most of us have. And it's called critical self-judgment. And, you know, that self-judge has an impact on someone's life and can really control somebody's life, I would imagine. I'm sorry, athletes are not immune from this.
The talk that we all give to ourselves can either give us confidence or, in the moment, inhibit our confidence. And one of the reasons that sports psychology to me is so interesting is it gives you a chance in the competitive moment to learn about a person's self-talk and then teach life skills. Because if someone tends to have difficulty with frustration on an athletic field, they tend to have difficulty with frustration in their personal life, their academic life, in their relationships. Mm-hmm. If someone tends to put aside what they do well and then focus on their mistakes, which many athletes do, that's a trait that tends to show up in other parts of their life. So if I'm able to help them, and it's a learned skill, in the heat of the moment, to let go of frustration, put a period on the end of it, focus in the present, think positive. If I'm able to help them learn that in the competitive situation, that can really help them outside the competitive situation in their personal life, too.
How, Joel? How?
In my mind, in the competitive situation, you take a look at the Olympics, for an example, it's most of those games have stoppages of play. And typically connected to the self-talk I feel is a feeling, either stressed or not, they're relaxed or not. And so my goal in a very highly competitive situation like the Olympics would be athletes to be able, in the heat of the moment, what am I feeling? Are my feelings too high, meaning I'm stressed, too low, I'm distracted? If so, I need to calm myself down, take a deep breath, repeat a bullet point of advice to myself. I was working with an athlete who's going to be Olympics now. In the heat of the moment, in the heat of competition, she would just repeat to herself, courage, the word courage. I can't believe I made that mistake. Courage. Before the competition starts, what if this courage. And sometimes if we have an anchor for our thoughts that gives the athlete perspective in the heat of the moment, helps them to keep their emotions not too high, not too low, their thought process in the moment. And I'm finding that those kinds of skills, where it may be easy for me to talk to you about it here with you, are really difficult when that adrenaline's pumping, when you've got people in the stands, when you have people yelling at you. So to be able to really focus on what you can control, which is your emotions, not too high, not too low, your thought process, I think is really empowering for an athlete. And those same skills can help the athlete in their personal life and not just in the competitive moment.
You're talking about mindfulness.
Mindfulness.
It's a moment of mindfulness. And I recommend that, you know, I talked to busy doctors at a grand rounds, you know, and I said, when you come into a hospital room, you know, they're thinking about their last patient. Just feel the temperature on the door. There's a metal door plate there. Just feel the temperature. Is it warm or cool? Just bring you back to where you are, you know, and that's exactly what you're saying. You know, there's, you're implying this. I've heard it said that a good athlete has to have no memory, and they got to work on that and train for that, and you help them get there. I want to tell you, this no memory thing came pretty easy for me, and it hasn't helped my performance worth a damn.
Well, I, you know, in sports psychology, we always talk about how to block out memory or distraction. And I'm learning, and this may be true in your clinical practice too, sometimes it's not helpful to say to someone, don't remember the last time you were in this situation. Don't remember. Athletes tend to think of the last time they were in a very similar situation. And my approach has really been more to, if you do start thinking about that, worrying about that, here's a plan to help you refocus on the present. And I think if you tell someone, don't think about that, don't think about that, don't think about that, it's like me saying to you, don't think about your belly button. All of a sudden you start thinking about it. So in athletics, when you're on the top of a mountain like these skiers or an ice skater, and you practice 4 years for this moment, they're going to have all kinds of feelings and thoughts. They're not machines. They're not robots. Right, right. If you do feel this, think this, here's your plan to focus in the moment, to calm down. And I'm finding that's a really more realistic way to approach moments you've been preparing for years, as opposed to telling someone, have a short memory, don't think about it, forget about it. That's my approach.
I didn't hear a word you said. I've been thinking about my belly button. I saw your lips moving, but I didn't. Let's go to the phones. We've got Lisa on the line. Hey, Lisa.
Hi there. I'm the mom of a college athlete. I'm wondering what the role of confidence is in all of this.
Say more. Why do you want to know? What do you want to know?
Because I'm not sure that the self-talk has worked for her as much as I would have thought it would. And I just wonder where confidence comes in terms of how you feel about your performance, what you anticipate, et cetera.
All right. I'm going to have Joel address that, but I don't want you to, I want you to hang on here because I want to talk to you, and I'm sure Joel does, about what it's like to be a mom of a high-level athlete. Joel?
I agree with you, Lisa, that confidence is like the foundation of a house. If confidence is solid, everything you build on top of it, including the self-talk, is going to be solid. If confidence is shaky, then it's really hard to build something solid on top of it. And we can talk about self-talk and relaxation and focus and mental preparation and visualization. The sport part of sports psychology is teaching those mental skills. That the psychology part of sports psychology, I'm a licensed psychologist by background, is trying to understand sometimes what's going on in the athlete's personal life that can be impacting on performance. So if the confidence issues, in my opinion, are really the basis of the performance issues, then sometimes it's important to go down the road of identity, self-esteem, and try to understand where the confidence issues lie, work on them a little bit, and then some of these mental skills, I think, have a better chance to take hold.
And let me just ask you a quick question about you, Lisa. What's all this like for you?
Painful.
Yeah. What part of it?
Well, not seeing her be very frustrated that the game she's loved since she was three and has invested so much time and energy in, it hasn't come together for her at the level that she would have liked.
Yeah, so
at the level that she expected of herself. So it's painful.
So this is about her expectations.
Her expectations of herself, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Lisa, I wish you the best. Boy, I sure hope what Joel said was helpful. And if she's interested, you know, you could have her listen to the show. You know, you can go on our website or we're podcast on iTunes. You know, it's easy to get. Okay? Thanks very much for your call. Joel, we're going to take a 60-second break here. We're going to come back. There's much more to talk about. I want to talk about young athletes, too. I know you're very involved there. We're talking about sports psychology with Dr. Joel Fish. He's the author of 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sports Parent, and he's got lots of great stories. And our number is 1-888-477-9499. Love to hear from you. Well, you're listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, right here on WHYY-FM.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcomes clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of Cognitive Behavior Therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and weight management. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. Beck Institute proudly supports WHYY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Guess what we're talking about today on Voices in the Family? Sports psychology. My guest is Dr. Joel Fish, a sports psychologist, and our number is 888-477-9499. You know, before a break, Joel, we were talking about the issue of self-confidence, and what we see a lot is athletes that seemingly have a great deal of self-confidence, but it's obnoxious. You know, we heard after the Super Bowl game, the cornerback Richard Sherman screaming that nobody can touch me, I'm the best in the game. So is that too much self-confidence, or is that what high-level athletes need?
I, in my experience, that's over the top, in that athletes tend to have a healthy dose of self-confidence, but if you're too over the top with self-confidence, it's hard for you sometimes to be really objective about those areas where you need to improve.
Uh-huh.
It's hard sometimes for your teammates to really see you as an equal, and the modeling of sportsmanship or lack of sportsmanship in that situation, which was beamed all over the world, to me is profoundly difficult. So I can't paint every elite athlete with the same brush, but in my experience, and I've worked with all the pro teams, as you mentioned earlier, that type of over-the-top confidence is not necessary in order to be an elite athlete. In fact, it can really backfire and work against you.
On the other hand, he argues, and a lot of other people do, I mean, this is a very, very bright man. And he's also a very, very reflective and introspective man. And what he argues is it's just this adrenaline rush. They caught him moments after, seconds after, you know, the Super Bowl victory in which he knocked down that pass. So they caught him right away, and there's all this adrenaline and excitement. That's got to be bypass your frontal lobes. That's all emotion.
And that's where the act itself I find troubling in terms of the sportsmanship piece, but I also found troubling some of the personality assessments that were done on him to explain that, because I agree with you. In the heat of the moment, and at that level, the adrenaline is really pumping, and you're playing on the biggest stage in the world. I'm surprised more athletes don't go over the top when they stick a microphone in their jaw immediately after a game. That the self-control that's required to go from 100 miles an hour back to zero or stop is something that most of us don't have to experience. So to draw too many personality characteristics or assessments or statements about him, I think is unfair to him.
The American Psychiatric Association says, I want to quote this, sports subject a person to a unique set of challenges and circumstances that can make a person vulnerable to feelings of depression and anxiety. So two things here, Joel. I want to know, what are the factors, and I would imagine all level of athletes, and there's got to be even more shame about having an anxiety disorder or depressive disorder with athletes.
On the positive side, we also know that sports, fitness, recreation can really be helpful in terms of depression and as part of a treatment. That pro athletes at the pro level also experience anxiety, that they experience depression for sure. And the key, oftentimes, other than physiological reasons, in my mind, has to do with the amount of one's identity that's placed on being a successful athlete and how we define success. And this is where I think, as parents and youth sport, things sometimes get a little out of whack. Those athletes who, at the pro level, who think of themselves as someone who plays a sport, not just a professional athlete. I'm John Smith, somebody said to me the other day, who plays professional basketball. I'm not John Smith, the basketball player. The identity piece at that level, which starts earlier on in the child's level, to me is the key towards whether that athlete is able to transition into post-athletics, if he or she gets injured and can't compete anymore, how devastating it can be. And also, in any game, if you are, quote, unsuccessful, or as the media might label some of these athletes in the Olympics now, a failure, you're able to deal with it better because not all your identity eggs are in that outcome basket. That, to me, is a critical variable of how athletes respond to their level of performance.
So, you know, we can, you know, I alluded to Bodie Miller at the beginning of the show and how he performed so poorly last night in the Olympics, but this was, I believe, his fourth Olympics or more, and I would assume his career is over now, or his Olympic career is over now. So I wonder about this transition with athletes, and we hear about, you know, athletes getting depressed or going bankrupt. We heard about NFL player Junior Seau committing suicide. Does the NFL have a program, for example, helping athletes make this transition?
Well, I know the NBA does, the NFL does, actually baseball does, and hockey does. So I think there are a couple of variables here. Bodie Miller, and this again depends on how he defines success,
sure,
came in eighth place because he was a half a second behind the winner in a sport like that.
Right.
And if he has defined success in a couple of different dimensions, and not just winning the gold medal. I'm participating in the Olympics. I gave it my best effort. Wow, what an opportunity. I learned something that's going to help me. I'm finding that the athletes can handle everybody else defining what they did as a failure or performing poorly and still come out of it with self-esteem. One of my first experiences in sports psychology, I was at the University of Wisconsin, and Beth Hyden, the Hydens were the speed skaters. She was favored to win 5 gold medals, and she won a bronze medal in speed skating. And I was at the press conference where she had to ward off a number of questions. How does it feel that you settled for a bronze? You failed. And she just was looking everybody in the eye because she had the perspective to say, I am in the Olympics. I am one of the top in the world. I gave it my best effort. I feel pretty good about what happened. Please don't call what I did a failure. So at the youngest ages, kids, parents, if we define success along 5 or 6 different dimensions and not just scoring more runs.
For example?
Effort. Johnny, did you give your best effort today? You were healthy. You had such an opportunity to run and play. I'm so proud of you. Did you learn something today that's going to make you a better person, a better athlete? Did you have fun? There was one athlete, 10-year-old boy, his goal was, did you smile once or twice in the course of the competition? Or look around and say, wow, look at what I'm doing. Were you a good teammate? Oh, by the way, what were your results? When the results become one way to define success as opposed to the only way, I think kids can learn how to navigate competition. And if the parents or the significant others are consistent with their behavior around that, I'm proud of you, win, lose, or draw, whether at the youth sport level or at the Olympic level, athletes are better able to navigate when they are successful, meaning results go their way, or when the results don't go their way.
That's so important. So important. We're talking with sports psychologist Joel Fish, author of 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sports Parent. Give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. We've got a couple of open lines, so call quickly. That's 1-888-477-9499. Love to hear about your athletic career, or even if you're a weekend warrior, tell us about the psychology you employ playing sports, or of course, a sports parent. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Holly on the line. Hi, Holly.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
I am the parent of a high school athlete who, you know, despite being born with a cardiothoracic condition and having a life expectancy of 2 years, plays multiple sports. She's a good athlete. She's not an elite athlete. And while watching the Olympics last night, she actually got this kind of forlorn face on and said, you know, I'm never going to get to that level. And basically, like, what's the point? And, Mom, do you think I could ever be in the Olympics for my sports? And I really struggle with, as a mom, how do I say to my daughter, you're a tremendous athlete, and realistically, no, I don't think you'll ever be in the Olympics. But I think it's hard for me as a parent because there's so much pressure put on, if you're not the absolute best, then you're not good enough. And I watch her, she comes off the field, if she doesn't have a good result, crying or throwing her hockey stick or kicking off her track shoes, whatever it is. And it's painful to me, just like the last caller said, that I see this wonderful young lady who has so much more than just sports. So how do you, as a parent, encourage your child to continue to do that sport that they love, balance that reality factor, and encourage them that, you know, sports is not the be-all and the end-all of the entire world?
So, Joe, you gave us the talking points a few minutes ago, but let's translate this now for Holly. So how do we actually do this? You can't just do it with words or talking points.
I really do believe the message that the parent gives the child. And one of the beauties of sport is it gives an arena for Holly, your daughter's son, to learn how to deal with frustration. You can't always get what you want. There are tremendous life lessons that more isn't always better. I can practice and I might not be an Olympic athlete. And to answer the first part of your question, yeah, I think all of us need to find a way just to say there's tremendous value in sport, even if you don't make it to be an Olympic athlete. For example, I'm 5'8". I could visualize dunking a basketball, I just can't dunk a basketball. And at some point, I needed to learn to accept that. What I really do believe, though, Holly, is that even though there's all kinds of messages from the Olympics, that to be number one is a goal, anything else in that isn't successful, that and there's all kinds of other forces out there in our society that we can't control that define winning as being number one, number two is losing, ESPN's on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. With all those forces out there that we can't control, the message you give your son or daughter as a parent, I am proud of you, I value effort, participation, skill development, I will help you try to improve. And whether you are first, second, third, or last, it's really the effort and the lessons you learn from the experience that I value. And if you do ask some of those questions I had said earlier after a competition about effort and learning and being a good teammate, I believe we plant seeds in our kids' minds that eventually sprout. And although that may not keep your son or daughter from being frustrated or crying after a competition today, tomorrow, the next day, a week from now, if you're consistent with that approach, I think they are going to learn the skills necessary to compete, give their best effort, get the best things out of sports, and learn to accept, just like in other parts of their life, that they may not be the best in the world.
Holly, I sure hope that was helpful. There's a book I think would be great for you to read. I can't remember the title. Joel, could you help me? It's something about sports and parents and, 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sports Parent by Joel Fish. Take a look at it. It's really helpful. And thanks for your call. We're talking about sports psychology today. That's pretty apparent with Dr. Joel Fish. He's a nationally recognized expert. He's consulted with the Flyers, Sixers, Phillies, USA Women's National Soccer Team. And give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol abuse? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the family training program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Have you ever been a caller on Radio Times? I'm Marty Moscoane, host of the show. WHYY does more than put stories and news on the air. We ask you to be part of our community, to be part of our conversation. Whether calling into Radio Times or Voices in the Family or attending a town meeting about the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, you are a vital part of this new service. We invite you to take the next step and join us as a member. Call 1-888-345-9499. Thanks.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with Joel Fish about sports psychology. We've gotten a couple of calls about from sports parents, and the issue is around achievement and performance. Joel, during our break, you said that it's not unusual for it to come up around the Olympics.
Because you're watching these elite performers, and so oftentimes young athletes or even weekend warriors start to wonder, what about me? And can I ever get there? And is there value if you don't get there? And just like I was trying to communicate to Holly, I think it becomes a real opportunity for us parents to talk to our kids about achievement, how we define success, continue to reinforce that we as parents just don't define success in terms of getting all A's or results. There's competition now in America is different in 2014 than 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. I think sports have always been part of our culture and have been status. But nowadays, whether Vince Lombardi really said it or not, winning has become everything and the only thing. And I think the Olympics become a time for parents and for athletes themselves to regain perspective on the value of participation and effort and learn how to define success in a broader way and not just being number one.
Apropos of that, Joel, you talked earlier about kind of controlling our internal thermostat as athletes, but you know, when I look at the general population, by and large, we don't have control of our internal thermostat. There's much more volatility out there. There's road rage. Little things seem so important, you know, when we overreact to stuff. How do you do it? How do you help them control their internal thermostat?
I think step one is to try to identify patterns of situations when those emotions start to control us rather than we control them. I was working with a professional quarterback recently who said when we're in an away stadium and we've got the ball on a 2-yard line and there's all kinds of noise and people waving their hand, I tend to have my stress level spike. So our plan was really just to prepare him for that specific situation. You're on the 2-yard line, people are calling you all kinds of names. Slow down, take a deep breath. The image he had was being the calm in the midst of a storm, like in a hurricane. The calmest place is right in the middle. And I think by breaking down, I get stressed in performance situations to specific situations. Where are your patterns? I think it became much more manageable for him to say to himself, okay, I'm learning how to control my emotions when the ball's on the 2-yard line rather than I can't handle stress. The biggest issue that comes to me from a performance point of view from all athletes and people who have to perform, it could be public speakers, it could be people who have deadlines, is I choke. I can't handle pressure. And 9 out of 10 times, they handle pressure fairly well. In most situations, there are very specific situations where they have trouble. And if we start with those specific situations, bosses watching you, mom and dad on the sideline, I made a mistake my first time at the plate, the second time up I get stressed. Now let's develop a mental game plan to handle that situation. Now that becomes much more manageable in terms of learning how to handle pressure rather than saying I'm a choker. And that's true, I find, both at the professional level and for the everyday person too.
I got my best sports education from my Little League coach. I loved baseball, and 1 year I made the All-Star team. So I get up there just like you're describing. I get up there the first time at bat, and I strike out. So the second time at bat, I say to the coach, pretending to be magnanimous, although I didn't know what that meant when I was 10, but I said, I'm not hitting well today, coach. Put somebody else in. Team player, you know? And he calls a timeout to the game, takes me out of the dugout. We walk up the third baseline with his arm around me. He says, son, he says, you're in the All-Star game. You're going to remember this game for the rest of your life. He said, you're going to tell your children and grandchildren about this game. It's a special time. And then we turn around towards home, and I'm like melting into this guy's body. And then we turn around towards home plate, and he kicks me in the ass, literally, hard. And he says, now get up there, and let's play for this team. Let's see what we can do up there. And I can't tell you which one felt better. You know, and both felt respectful to me. You know, it was just interesting. I felt proud.
It is also interesting to me that just in the course of our conversation, you flipped to a memory when you were 10 years old. And
yeah.
Almost every presentation I ever give, I always start out with, can you think of your earliest competitive memory? And literally everybody has a memory. Most of the time, before the age they were 10 years old, that with everything that's happened in their life
right.
since then, they remember in detail, just like you did. Those early memories, really, I think, are significant in terms of shaping our attitudes about winning and losing and success, failure, and competition. And in working with adults, a lot of times I like to go back to some of those early memories so that just like you did, you were able now as an adult to pull something out of that that could be helpful for you in competition or to deal with stress today. Those early memories often represent some mental blocks for us to try new things, to show courage,
yeah.
to make mistakes. And if we reframe them just like you did, it can really free us up.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Patty on the line. Hi, Patty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering, I may be on the other end. I have a young athlete that has huge potential. But I think he's lacking the drive. Like, I don't know, where does a parent stand, you know, to encourage them to, you don't want to, I don't want to belittle him or, you know, but, like, practice. You have to practice. You have to do this every day, you know. Like, how far is a parent supposed to push?
Does he want to practice?
He doesn't want to practice. No, he just wants to go play the game, and he's very good with limited practice. And so,
what age is he?
He's got a lot of natural ability. He's 12. And he's got a lot of ability, more so than my other kids. And you know, I see that in him, and I feel like he may be squandering that gift, if you will. You know, but then you don't know if you. Do you push harder? Do you, do I let him do what makes him happy? You know,
Joel, it's a good question.
A great question. And the rule of thumb there, Patty, is usually to follow the child's lead. And I can't guarantee too many things, but I have a feeling we could be having a different conversation when he's 14 or 15 or 16. Developmentally, sometimes interests change and the ability to persevere changes. And just with experience and maturity, especially around that 12-year-old age, things can change. The other piece, and I'm not saying it's true with your son, but I've seen this before, is the potential at that age, 12 years old, is a very, very, very mixed bag because people expect certain things of you. And, you know, I was dealing with a 13-year-old who was a tremendous track person, and he felt like a couple of his friends were starting to get jealous of him because he had all this skill and people were starting to recognize it. So sometimes, I'm not saying it's true in your son's case, it takes a while for a child to learn how to deal with the fear of failure, but also the fear of success. And if left to their own devices, more often than not, the motivation level can change. Having said that, just because a person is skilled physically doesn't mean they develop a love of the sport. And so it's something you need to keep your eye on. But the rule of thumb is that the child has to be showing up to practice at least 51% each day because they choose to, they want to, not because they have to, they must, they ought to, they should. And that's the rule of thumb, I think, in terms of parents' practice and working with kids who have potential.
I also want to mention, Patty, that one person's encouragement is another person's nagging. And the research shows that when that happens, you're both miserable. You know, that be happier. You know, just the happier you are, you know, the happier your family's going to be. Just, you know, do things that make you happier, not things that make you more miserable. Joel?
And I want to add there, too, that a lot of times I see parents who are caught. They really want to advocate for their child that has potential, but yet they don't want to go overboard either. I was working with an ice skating family last year. Their daughter was told she had Olympic potential. And on the one hand, they wanted to provide their daughter with all the resources to be the best she could be. That's advocacy for parents. So on the other hand, they were aware of going overboard and in skating. There's a shark-infested waters, as they would say it. So I understand, Patty, sometimes as a parent, it's really hard to understand what it means to advocate for your child, especially when they're skilled. Again, I'm asking you to trust that in time the child's motivation level may change and that we want to follow the child's lead in terms of at least 51% the child being there because he or she chooses, even if it means taking off a season. You know, specialization is such a big issue right now with kids with potential. Just because kids have potential, it's not always helpful for them to play all year round, for example. That's necessarily not good for their motivation or interest.
I hope that's helpful for you, Patty, and thanks so much for your call. Joel, let's go right back to the lines. We've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. We've got Chris on the line. Hey, Chris.
How you doing?
I'm okay.
I have a 12-year-old son, and he's a wrestler. And then he's struggling early on in the year with his confidence and how to handle losses. And I did some of the stuff that you're exactly saying now. I told him to take something positive from a loss, something to work on. And he's been doing better with his frustration. And this weekend he wrestled in his middle school tournament, and he took fourth. And he lost in a hard match, and he was all dejected. And I was trying to look for something to tell him to make him feel better. I said, how many guys are in your bracket? And he said, 10. And I said, you're the fourth best kid in the whole area in middle school? And his eyes brightened up, and he looked up and he said, yeah. And that's all it took was just another angle looking at the box. And the first thing he said to his mom when he went in, came in the house, is like, I'm the fourth best kid in the area in middle school. And he felt proud, and he saw the achievement in it. And my real question is, like, why isn't there more emphasis on this with these youth coaches to just even have, like, one practice dedicated to, or a letter or some sort of pamphlet so that they can give some positive influence? So I coach these kids, and I see some really awful stuff on the sidelines. Like, a dad this weekend punched the wall when his kid lost. And I'm sitting here at my son, and I'm like, I said to him, I said, how do you think that kid feels when his dad does that? And he says, not very good. I mean, it's just... There just needs to be a little bit more emphasis on this side of it, as well as physical and getting them prepared for the game.
Boy, are you right. Kids just aren't having fun these days in a lot of organized sports.
More kids are playing sports than ever before, girls and boys, and 30% are dropping out because it's not fun.
I want to ask you something, though, and this we haven't talked about much. When my grandson Sam's a wrestler. He's 13 now. He's been wrestling for maybe 5 years. Early on in his career, when he was little, first couple of years, he would lose. And he would win, and then he'd lose, and he would cry after he lost, you know, go to the sidelines. First couple of years he ran to his mother, and then, you know, he just bucked up and just cried to himself. So, you know, Sam and I had a talk. And I said, so, Sam, what do you think's going on here? So he says, Pop, he said, I don't think I'm tough enough. He said, could you toughen me up? What about that? What about toughening up athletes or kids? I mean, it's a politically complicated issue here.
My response is similar to what I was thinking when Chris spoke, that... Yeah. Chris, first of all, was consistent in the way he said it, not just in the words. I'm proud of you. And sometimes as parents we can give mixed messages. I'm proud of you, but we're showing with our body language we're disappointed. And the other thing in terms of your grandson and Chris is sometimes it's a timing thing. Like kids 8 to 12 years old, sometimes they need to cry when they don't win. And if we jump in too quickly with don't worry about it, well, we're not giving them a chance at that developmental age to get something out of their system that they need to so that they can be more receptive to your message.
It's a loss.
It's a loss. That hurts.
Yeah.
Especially, let's put the 8 to 12 cap on, you tend to think in black or white terms. They're learning how to deal with frustration, but if I win, I'm good. If I don't win, I'm not good, the way some kids. So I think it's understandable they cry. Then 10, 20, 30 minutes later, let's come in with the perspective. Sometimes I think as parents, and I know it from my own three kids, you want to just jump in and sort of save them from the disappointment. And so I think the words of perspective get lost in that situation. I do think
that's our job. That's always our job, isn't it, as parents, is to have perspective. It's a critical part of parenting.
There is something about sport, though, that just pushes buttons in parents that I happen to believe, and I've been involved in some parent situations that really went over the top. The vast majority of parents are well-intentioned, but when you see your kid up there with the bases loaded, something deep down inside gets activated. So a lot of times parents will say to me, I can't believe I said that. I can't believe I did that. Because it's easy to get caught up in the heat of the moment.
Hmm. We're just about out of time. Joel, I think we've sold a lot of your books today. I'm going to take a minute and engage in some news for my listening audience that I'm really excited about. My new book is available for pre-purchase. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's called The Wisdom We're Born With, and that's what you've been alluding to. The Wisdom We're Born With, Reawakening Faith in Ourselves. So, Joel, I want to thank you so much. It's been a blast. It always is when you come. And thanks for the work you're doing. Sounds like so much fun. If you want to download our podcast, you can go to whyy.org/voices or iTunes or my website at drdangottlieb.com and follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Well, our engineer today has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. Oh, I'm Dan Gottlieb. I forgot. Hey, listen, have a good week, my friends. Enjoy the Olympics.